You're listening to Fundraising Radio, a podcast about fundraising for early stage startups. The major rule that we follow here is no bullshit on this podcast. No music to relax you, no advertisements of our sponsors. We only talk about fundraising here and nothing else. So let's jump into the episode. And today's guest speaker, we have Christopher Lustrino, founder and CEO at King's Crowds. And this episode, we'll talk about equity crowdfunding. How is it different from normal crowdfunding? How King's Crowd was raising its own money, and why did they decide to raise all of their rounds through online funding? So, Christopher, let's kick it off by you giving us some background on yourself and on King's Crowd.
Sure thing, Constantine. Great to be here. Thanks for the opportunity. So I started King's Crowd about 3 years ago now, and my kind of foray or journey to starting King's Crowd was having started my career working for a management consulting firm, learning about the traditional private equity markets and some of the challenges that existed there. For those that don't know, private equity, venture capital, right? Essentially all they are funds that are raised, which is basically a bunch of money in order to invest in companies and buy companies, with the long-term goal for any of those organizations to sell those companies for a whole lot more than they get in on that. And basically during my time supporting and working on behalf of private equity shops, I learned about the challenges around doing private equity due diligence type work. I learned about how non-transparent the private equity markets could be. And worst of all, I learned that I couldn't partake in the private equity markets, because up until about 5 years ago now, unless you were an accredited investor, which means, you have at least $1 million in assets, that doesn't include your home, or you've made a certain level of income, which only represents about 3% of all of our United States economy, you couldn't invest in private companies. And the only thing available to you was companies on public stock exchanges like Google and Facebook. But a lot of the growth happens before those companies ever go public. So it was really that was the inspiration to say, why can't I invest in the private markets? Why can't this be done better? And that's when I stumbled upon the Jobs Act, which was created in 2012 and fully enacted by 2016, which tried to solve for both of those issues that I'm talking about, which are really around transparency and access. So the Jobs Act said, hey, what if we let everyone invest in the private markets, but in exchange for allowing to raise capital from literally anyone in the United States, companies will have to be a lot more transparent around things like their financials and valuation. And hey, by the way, let's let everyday investors be able to invest in these companies when they're still really early days, to potentially be able to partake in the type of upside that venture capitalists and private equity shops get to partake in. Ended up running a blog in that space for a few years, then ended up being acquired by one of the founders of Napster from way back in the day. And at that time, back in 2018, we decided to build a first mover solution, which would essentially be the first Morningstar Bloomberg solution for what we define as the online private market. So we work on behalf of individual investors to be able to invest into private companies that are listing on platforms like Republic.co, WeFunder.com, NetCapital.com, StartEngine.com, and many, many more. Essentially trying to empower you to make good investment decisions when it comes to investing in private companies.
Mm-hmm. Right. Quick question on that, by the way. Are you working as advisors, or are you working as a more of a fund where LPs have to make a commitment and you just invest on their behalf?
So the way that you could think about it is really, as an information research provider. Mm-hmm. So we're very much like a Bloomberg or a Morningstar, providing the research that individual investors can purchase and utilize to do their own due diligence before investing in a private company.
Gotcha. Speaking of purchasing this, maybe some of our listeners might be interested. What prices are we talking about here?
Yeah. So our starting price tier is at $10 a month. Okay. And that's, if you're looking for one pick a month and then being able to look at some of our other various research and news, and then it goes as high as $50 a month for investors.
Nice. That's very interesting. My brother might be interested in that. So let me ask you a couple more questions on what exactly you get for 10 bucks per month. So you said that it's going to be one pick. What is going to be included in this kind of research in the company? Is it going to be mostly about the team on the background of it, or is it going to be about the tech, or is it going to be just like literally everything at all? Or what kind of information can one expect for $10 per month?
Yeah, so you know, basically what you're going to get at $10 per month is, first off, you'll have the ability to sort and look through all of the companies that kind of exist in this universe of the online private markets and look for certain criteria you care about and be able to get a very simple profile on each company. And it's going to break down how much money they're raising, what their momentum looks like, valuation, terms of the deal, all sorts of stuff on the deal. But in terms of each month, you'll receive two analyst reports. So if you've ever bought into a public stock like Google or Facebook, you may have read an analyst report that, you know, provides a strong buy or buy rating. Well, we have something very similar for this market. So if you buy into our $10 a month package, we will provide you two analyst reports per month, as well as some founder profiles, exclusive webinars, some advanced company search tools, but you'll basically get the basics for what you need. Now, if you go all the way up to the $50 a month plan, what we do is we provide all of our analyst reports. There's probably about 20 a month that come out, in addition to our rating reports. So each and every company in this universe, which is probably about almost 500 new companies a month now that raise capital online, you can actually get a quantitative rating on each and every one of those companies. Nice. And so that's part of the, you know, $50 a month plan. But that's really if you want to start drilling down and doing much larger scope diligence and looking at way more deal flow, things like that.
Very cool. I'm pretty sure my brother is going to get that $10 subscription. I'll definitely send it to him after this call. All right. Got distracted. Let's go back to discussing raising money online. So you mentioned that your King's Crowd raised its entire funding online. Can you tell us a bit more about that? What do you mean by saying it raised money online?
Great question. So we've raised about a little over $2 million to date at this point from about 2,100 investors.
Nice.
When I say that we've raised capital online, allowing investors to own a piece of our company, I literally mean that. We have basically allowed for a certain number of shares to be sold online. We've gone through something called filing a Form C with FINRA, where we basically put out some audited financials. We put in, you know, our valuation, operating agreements, some bad actor checks around the C-suite. And then with that information, we're able to list on a platform called netcapital.com. We also raised on a platform called startengine.com. We've done about three total raises to date online, and collectively they've raised a little over $2 million. And essentially, we provided common stock at a certain price valuation and allowed people to buy in and own those shares and literally own a piece of our company when it was still worth, you know, south of $10 million. So still very, very early days with hopefully the potential of some real upside.
Nice. So 2,100 investors, that's a hell of a lot of investors. Can you tell us a bit more about, you know, how do you utilize that huge, huge number of investors in your company?
Absolutely. So first off, you know, there's kind of this common misconception, wow, that must be really hard to manage 2,100 investors. The reality is it's all managed under one line item on the cap table, and the communications are controlled through the platforms that we have utilized. So essentially, I put together a quarterly update and I send it to the platform. The platform sends it to our 2,100 investors. If we get, you know, 3 to 5 responses a quarter, typically just kind of high-fiving us and saying, hey, that's fantastic. How else can I help? there really is very little laborious, you know, interactions that need to be had. So for those who think it becomes this huge, big problem, it absolutely does not. And I have had zero issue, nor have I really heard any founders talk about having an issue of managing so many investors. And then, you know, the other thing that I would say is it's a little bit like the public markets where, you know, we have 2,100 investors. I bet you, you know, 2,050 of them represent about 30 or 40% of our funding, and then about 50 of them represent the other, you know, 50, 60% of our funding. So it's always a game of, you know, the big checks and little checks, but collectively we need them all in order to accomplish our goals, which I think is always really, really cool. But in terms of how we use them, my gosh, there's so many different things, you know, from as simple as, you know, having them become customers and advocates of our business, and believe me, many, many of them are. I think nearly all of them are, you know, subscribed to our newsletter list and things like that. Many are paid customers and are very much advocates. We've had people tweet at us. We had one guy who he's a CMO at another company, and he had a little leftover budget from a project. So he actually spent money from that budget. It was just going to be lost. He's like, this is going to be lost in a pit of money. He's like, I'm just going to use that money and buy you guys some stickers for with the King's Crown logo that you can pass around to people at events. And it's just so cool to see that kind of ambassadorship and wanting to be a part of our brand, you know? And then we've gone so far as having advisors and individuals become employees that initially started out as just kind of these, you know, blind name checks going into our deal.
Nice. Very cool. There is one phrase that you said that caught my eye, which is the response rate to the quarterly updates. You said 3 to 5 responses per quarter.
It's been extremely, extremely low. You know, it's mostly congratulations and things like that. We don't get much. Basically, people are happy to be kept in the know. We tell them about what's going well, where there's challenges, what the opportunities are. Uh-huh. And people are happy with that. There's really, you know, there's not a lot of questions being asked. And the way that I think a lot of these investors look at it, this is a passive investment for the long term. And so they're not, you know, hounding on you, when are you going to IPO? They kind of recognize the reality of what they're getting into, which is a long game. So it's been really nice to see. And it's been great, you know, to have an investor base that isn't challenging to deal with, and in fact is really an advocate of our business.
Right. So let's talk a little bit more about that involvement, engagement specifically. The high engagement rate of those investors is probably one of the key, you know, factors of some founders choosing equity crowdfunding over, you know, normal crowdfunding from VC. I mean, over normal funding from VCs and angels. You know, this ability to reach out to 2,100 investors and ask for help, and then get the help immediately, because I mean, there are 2,100 people that you're talking to. Have you ever done this kind of, you know, targeted outreach to those investors of yours, asking for specific help, saying like, here is the immediate problem that we're having, and it's a massive problem, we need your help. Have you ever done something like that?
It's a great question. One of the things we did, in fact, do was during our last round of funding. It was an accredited only round of funding, but it was still online. Nonetheless, we can only raise from accredited investors. And, mm-hmm. and so we kind of reached out and we said, listen, we're raising, you know, at the moment, this is an accredited only round on the same platform that we've utilized in the past, Net Capital. You know, if you want to partake, please just fill out this short survey. And we sent out the survey to all of our investors, and you know, we ended up getting at least a couple hundred responses of yes, I want to invest. A bunch of them were not accredited, and they let us know. And then we you know, put them on a list for, hey, for future raises, we'll definitely reach out. Mm-hmm. But many of them were, and I have to tell you, I mean, they really stepped up, where we were getting 10, 25, and 50K checks from folks that, you know, I had never talked to before, who had just invested, you know, maybe $500, $1,000 in the first round of funding, but then watched us for almost 2 years and saw the progress we made and said, hey, I want to be a part of this, which was really, really cool.
Mm-hmm. Right. That sounds very cool, actually. Using those investors to just keep raising, that's pretty good. All right. Let's talk a little bit more about the quote-unquote normal investors and how they react to the fact that you raised 100% of your funding online. Have you ever encountered VCs who are like old school? I've interviewed a few of those who are like, yeah, crowdfunding is for people who can raise money in a normal way. And we, of course, had a pretty good debate about that stuff, but I think they're wrong. Anyways, that aside, have you ever met those investors, and what was the major issue for them, you know?
Absolutely, we have. And what's the issue for them? You know, being stuck in the past, right? There's not very many good answers to that. It's definitely short-sighted. And you know, a part of saying, hey, it's short-sighted, I mean, I can't tell you the innumerable companies who've raised on these platforms that are Y Combinator backed, that are 500 Startups backed, that are Kleiner Perkins backed, that are Andreessen Horowitz backed. And then companies go in the reverse direction. There was one recently, and I'll have to get you the name, but they raised on Republic. A few months later, they raised a huge up round from Andreessen Horowitz. There was another company on Republic recently, Alto IRA. You know, I think they raised at a $30 million valuation. on Alto IRA, or it was a cap of 30 million. And then a couple months later raised a $17 million Series A from several notable VCs at a $90 million valuation. So talk about, you know, being a happy investor for just a few months. So the reality is, you know, it's becoming mainstream. A lot of companies in the ecosystem of seed and Series A companies now have some sort of crowdfunding that have been a part of them. And I think the, you know, the forward-thinking VCs recognize that, listen, this is just another part of the capital stack. It has its role in the market, and there's absolutely no reason to look down on it. If you can effectively raise from your customer base, it's just another signal that perhaps this thing really works.
Absolutely. That should be 100% the logic for those investors. And by the way, speaking of raising from your customer base, I've interviewed a founder of a company that is doing Cafe, which is like safe but online. Check it out. I'll leave an interview link in the description of this episode. So if people you are curious about raising money specifically from your customers, that's definitely an interview for you. Anyways, back to our discussion, back to something you've mentioned, which is more of a financial scrutiny while you raise from the public. You've mentioned that you yourself had to file through FINRA, which I didn't even know you had to do for crowdfunding. Why exactly did that happen? Do every single company, do all of them have to file through FINRA when they go public through a crowdfunding campaign?
Yeah, exactly right. So essentially, you know, the agreement was, okay, you can raise capital online, but if you're going to raise capital online, you essentially have to give us something back, right? Which is transparency. So in order to prevent founders coming into this space and trying to screw over investors, in order to prevent fraud, essentially said, listen, you have to provide us, you know, audited financials. If you're looking, I forget the exact number, if it's over 250,000 now, the number has changed because under regulation crowdfunding, you can now raise $5 million per year from the general public. So once you're above a certain threshold of how much money you want to raise, it has to be audited. Prior to that amount, you just have to have reviewed financials. Either way, you have to have accountants put together financials and do some level of review or audit on those financials. You have to disclose the terms of the deal, how much money you're trying to raise, the time period you're trying to raise within. In many ways, you could think of it as a super mini IPO because you are essentially going public. You're allowing individual investors to partake and invest in your deal. And while there's no, you know, secondary liquid market at the moment, eventually that will be something that exists as well. So in order to raise from this much broader base of capital, you have to give something back to investors, which is transparency around your business.
Right. So it's a mini IPO, as you said, which is probably the case, and it takes quite some time to prepare for it. So who do you think should be actually doing it instead of raising from angels and VCs, where you can just reach out to a person, come there, they're going to give you a check, you're going to give them a piece of paper, they're going to sign it, and bam, off you go. Who should choose equity crowdfunding over, you know, the simple old school fundraising?
You know, to be honest, and I know that I'm biased on this, but in so many ways, I say that seriously, this is good for everyone. And the reason I say that is that if you think about, you know, friends and family round, there's so many folks who say, hey, listen, my friends and family don't have a lot of money. But, you know, in my case, nor did really my friends and family have all that much money either. But the nice thing is suddenly it becomes approachable, right? Where instead of saying, well, I need a 25 or 50K check buy-in, you'd say, I need a $100 buy-in. I can't tell you how many friends from high school I had partake, and how many, you know, family members I had partake, and how many former colleagues I had partake and investing in our first round of funding. And they really were the ones that helped me get off the ground. And again, collectively we raised about 100 grand, and it was from a little over 80 folks, right? So each one of them was around a $1,000 check. Many were $100, few were $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, but there was no major checks in that round of funding. But what it did is it, you know, it provided the necessary funding to take the steps to prove that we really had something to then go and raise a more meaningful round of funding down the road. But the beauty of doing it online is that everyone can be an investor. I've had angel groups invest, I've had micro VCs invest, I've had very wealthy, very successful individuals invest, you know, really large checks, and everything in between. And so the reality is, if you do this right, everyone can partake in these rounds of funding. And why not go set the terms and raise money on your own terms and be able to cast the widest network possible? So for me, it makes all the sense in the world to do it, you know, at any stage of the game. And, you know, we see a ton of companies raising, you know, pre-seed, seed, and now even Series A. And I think it's really becoming an effective tool to do so.
Mm-hmm. Nice. That's actually a great argument. If you have a decent personal network of not extremely wealthy people who cannot be accredited investors or even close to that, yeah, equity crowdfunding is actually a really great place to start. That's very, very good and strong argument towards equity crowdfunding. Good work, Chris. While you were answering that, by the way, I was thinking about what my next question is going to be. And I was thinking that, you know, mostly we discuss how people fundraise, but we never really speak about how they spend their money that they raised. So let's talk about that for a little bit. After you raised that initial round from friends and family through equity crowdfunding, what were the first couple steps that you took?
Yeah, I think, you know, the big things that we did was focus on product development and finding product market fit. So for us, you know, we had a true MVP out in market when we went to raise that first round of funding. And it was funny, people would say all the time, like, well, you know, you say you want to be this data and analytics platform, but this practically looks like a block. I'm like, it doesn't practically look like that. It is that for now. I have no technical capability. And until I have that, I'm not going to be able to build those tools. What I'm showing here is that people are willing to pay for some research, right? So I started with what I knew, which was basically qualitative research, until I raised enough money to hire some tech talent, who then was able to take the steps to take it out of MVP form and start to add in, you know, actual data capabilities and collecting data from all of these marketplaces. And we started to evolve the brand forward towards what our actual vision was. So we spent a lot on product and getting folks to help us out on the product front. And then the other thing was just doing small marketing campaigns and going to events and getting the word out there about us. And it was not with the idea that, okay, we're going to blow up and have 10 million users on our platform. What we wanted to do is prove that we could get people to pay for the service and that they actually valued it and wanted it. And we were definitely able to get enough, you know, where we could show, hey, at least a couple hundred or a few hundred people wanted to pay for this thing when we had a marketing budget of maybe, you know, $10,000 or less, and no one even knows what we are just yet. And it was just to prove the point that, yes, there is a market for what we're building. And yes, we're able to execute and build when we raise capital. Now give us more capital to really take this thing to the next level.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Yeah. MVP stage is the most fun, the most exciting, and pretty frequently the hardest stage of it. Congrats on pulling through this. All right. Moving on to the very last question of today's episode, which is a call to action. So, Chris, what do you want the listener to do as soon as the episode is over?
You know, I think there's depends on what party you are. If you are an investor, then I really encourage you to go look at platforms like WeFunder.com, SeedInvest.com, Republic.co, StartEngine.com, NetCapital.com. Learn about this market. Check it out. Get a feel for it. Obviously, come to us. We would love to have you. We'd love for you to utilize our product. We provide really robust due diligence research tools. We make your, you know, discovery and due diligence process way more efficient than looking across these zillion different marketplaces. But just start to orient yourself to this space and think about, can I make a small allocation of my overall investment portfolio focused on this new market where I can invest in these really early stage deals? And then for founders, I would say, you know, think really critically about your capital raising strategy. Don't think that this isn't something that should be a part of it, and start considering your options. So again, go to those marketplaces as well, even more so for you, and get a sense of the types of companies that are raising, the valuations they're raising at, how much money they're raising, get comfort with it, and then really think strategically about if you want to start reaching out to them. To, you know, ask if they would allow you to raise capital on their platform. And certainly if you're looking for intros or want to learn more about those platforms, have questions, please do reach out to me at chris@kingscrowd.com. I'm always more than happy to help if I can.
Perfect. Great call to action. My call to action is going to be check out the description of this episode. Bunch of links is going to be there, such as a link to the episode about Coffee, which is an alternative to the standard safe. So yes, a lot of stuff about equity crowdfunding is going to be there. And my next call to action, I have to for this one, unfortunately, my next call to action is actually check out the next episode, because the next episode is going to be an educational episode. again with Chris about equity crowdfunding, specifically how you do it. We're going to do a step-by-step guide on how to approach it and who should actually approach it. So yes, do that. Check out the next episode. It's going to be marked with something like educational. So go check it out. If you're curious about equity crowdfunding, about online crowdfunding in general, it's going to be good.